So I'm here with Professor Charles Spence, who is a Professor of Experimental Psychology at Somerville College in Oxford. And he will be doing a talk as part of the Oxford Literary Festival. And that is with Fred Plotkin, who is an opera expert and author of a couple of cookery books as well. And this talk is called Music in the Mouth, How Music Affects the Way Things Taste, which sounds very interesting, but also slightly unusual. But this is the kind of research you're doing, right? It's about senses and how they combined, how they affect the way we do things, I guess.
That's right. So at the Crossmodal Research Lab in the psychology department, have a team of people looking at the senses and how they interact. So how what you smell might change what you see, and what you hear might change what you feel. But more and more we're looking at the world of taste and flavour and all the kinds of things that affect our experience of the food on the plate and the drink in the glass. And probably over the last 5 years, we've kind of, where we are now isn't a strange place, but it kind of makes sense if you go from the beginning, which was about a decade ago, we were looking at the sound of crunchy crisps. And showing how you could make things sound, taste crunchier and fresher by changing the sound of the crunch as people bit into them. And from there, we've been looking at the sounds of a wrinkling crisp packet. The noisier the packet, the crispier the crisps. And from there, it's gone out to kind of things like the sound of the seafood dish served at the Fat Duck these days, which again kind of sort of makes sense if you're eating seafood, then maybe kind of congruent sounds work. And ultimately, we've ended up at the world of kind of music and taste. Music and flavour, something that you find kind of wine writers talking about here and again. They'll sort of refer to a wine. This is like, I don't know, Dizzy Gillespie or something. This wine needs, you know, sort of serious emotion. It needs, you know, major chords. So you find those things in the literature, and we've been looking to see whether there's any kind of truth or generality under it, such that if I give you something to taste, a wine or some other drink, will you tend to pick the same sorts of musical notes as the next person who comes in and the other 20, and will you pick the same kinds of instruments that correspond or go together with certain tastes?
So during the talk, are you going to be, or are people in the audience going to be tasting foods as well? And, or is it sort of, you have to take your word for it?
Well, these are things you can try at home, certainly. And there are sounds that one can download from the web now. So we've got sounds of bitter, sweet, salty and sour.
Oh, really?
Sounds like kind of music that will... Well, between music and soundscapes, that will make add 5 or 10% sweetness to your dessert.
To something that you're already eating.
Right. So one easy way is we give people sort of 3 cups of coffee, and one might have a couple of spoons of sugar, very sweet. And you ask people to say, how sweet is that? And they say, I don't know, 6 out of 10 on the sweetness scale. Then give them a cup with only half as much sugar, but play some a bit of music. They're low pitched and sort of brassy, and they'll say, oh, it's very bitter, nothing like the first one. And then give them the same cup of coffee again, but this time playing sweet music, and suddenly that drink tastes sweet to people. And from there, we can do sweet and bitter are kind of the easiest musically to match. Sour is pretty easy as well, but salty is very hard, and we're sort of working with umami, this kind of, you know, proteinaceous taste, to see whether we can find music for that too. And some of these sounds, I hope we'll be playing them during the session. Whether people get to taste anything there depends on health and safety and such like, but I would certainly try and do it if I could. But these sounds are available online, some of them, and some of the music is also kind of currently listenable too at the Science Museum in London. For the next year, there's kind of a food exhibition, and some of the experiments, kind of citizen science thing that people can take part in, involve listening to some sounds and deciding what taste they are.
And what sort of... the benefit of this, because I can sort of see how big companies might want their crisps to taste crunchy and things like that. Is that kind of where you
should go? Well, wouldn't you want, you know, if you're eating a stale crisp, wouldn't you rather it was crunchy?
Sure, yeah, but I mean, is it a commercial benefit?
Okay, so a lot of the funding for the lab has come from industry over the years, and certainly a lot of big brands are very interested in trying to design sort of sensory apps that you can, you know, buy some product or other, scan the label or the QR code on the label, and you'll be able to download some recommendations about the music to listen to, the chair to sit in while you have your chocolate bar or whatever it might be. So that kind of world of sort of sensism and delivering more content is very big and growing bigger. We've seen last year now, Häagen-Dazs kind of launched a concerto app where you scan their ice cream and then you can see through your mobile device some musicians playing over the ice cream tub. 2 minutes later, they wrap up and finish, and that's the time when your ice cream's supposedly ready to scoop.
Oh, okay.
We went to Berlin in April for a big champagne and music event, so it captures interest there. But beyond that, we're working a lot with chefs to try things out. So this bittersweet sounds that we have were developed with the Fat Duck Research Kitchens. Because it was only a 5-10% increase in sweetness, not a fall off your chair change in sweetness. It ended up at the House of Wolf restaurant in Islington. So the chef there and the culinary artist were very interested in using that as part of their dining experience. And from there, we're seeing now British Airways just before Christmas launching a musical digital seasoning. You go on long haul, you can choose your food to some degree, and then you just plug in your headset and choose the channel that matches the taste of the food to bring out a certain taste. So I think it is gaining an interest, and I was pleased to see just last month that in New Zealand, in Christchurch, New Zealand, the world's first sonic wine bar opened up from a professional New Zealand wine judge who goes around the world judging the competitions. But in some of the talks she does, she also plays music and changes the taste of wine. And this is like a wine expert saying this stuff is real, not just the psychologists. And she's a part of, I think, this venture to open the first sonic wine bar to order your wine. And then if we know that the music can bring something out, make the wine taste better, why on earth wouldn't you want the two to match one with the other?
Just to pick up on something you said, I think it would seem to me that having something that makes a subtle change might be better, actually, than having something that makes an enormous difference, because I think I'd be quite put off if something changed so dramatically.
Yeah, so maybe it depends how it's done.
Yeah.
Certainly, I mean, maybe we've all had the experience that things do change completely, taste completely different when we taste the wine on holiday in the Mediterranean and then bring it bottle back and it doesn't taste the same. It's completely different, but that's kind of over a bigger time frame when you can always say it's something about the way that the bottle travelled in the air or something. So you're right when it happens in very quick succession. So in one event last year, we had 3,000 people in London at the South Bank Centre, and we were changing the lighting and we were changing the music as they were tasting a glass of wine. And there I could show the lighting and the music both impacted what was in the glass. And people were, some not all, but several hundred were kind of writing comments after the event saying how amazing, how rapidly... You know, the lights changed, the music changed, and suddenly what I got out of the wine in the glass changed. I know it's the same wine. It was still in my hand all the time, and yet it did have that change, which can be surprising, can be fun. It could be off-putting, I suppose, if things change too much, because we kind of believe, well, whatever's in our glass or cup tastes the same and it won't change. That's kind of our belief about the world. But behind the scenes, I could say some of the world's big food companies are playing with that assumption that the flavour of things doesn't change from one end of the wrapper to the other, or from one end of the drink to the other, in order to almost, if you have something that, and you deliver a very sweet first taste, say in the first bite of your Mars bar or something, then your brain will assume the rest of it's going to be equally sweet. So could you put all the sugar at the first and the last mouthful and less in the middle, and your brain would just fill in the gaps and say, that's a really sweet, I really like it, but have less calories as a result?
Okay.
And maybe, we don't know. So most of our experiments are all kind of short term. You come into the lab or the restaurant or somewhere and we give you something to taste, or maybe a few things to taste and change the music and see whether your ratings change. We don't know if you listen to the sweet music for a year every day at lunch, at dinner time, would it still have its effect?
Yeah.
Or would it wear off? You just say, okay, your brain would kind of realise, well, something that music, the food isn't as sweet as I think it is. And kind of adjust in the way that we do when you start eating low calorie meals then.
Yes, if there are people who have only ever listened to one type of music or something like that, does that mean their tastes are always slightly different?
Well, it completely depends how loud it is, because a lot of sort of restaurant critics now are starting to not only rate the food, but rate the loudness of the music in the restaurants where that food is served. And, you know, 3 out of 5 for the food, but, you know, 1 out of 5 stars for the sound levels. I couldn't hear the waiter and she couldn't hear me. And the research shows that the level that you find the music in many contemporary restaurants, which is about over 100 decibels, it's not only is it dangerous for those who are working there long term, but it also significantly suppresses your ability to taste the food itself. So too loud, and it's definitely going to impact and interfere with all of our ability to taste food. Quieter than that, I do have a sort of pet hypothesis that maybe the kind of music we listen to some degree affects the choices we make about the things we buy. So if I get into a supermarket and it's French music playing, the results of numerous studies suggest you'll be more likely to buy the French wine. Even if you've got, you know, a schnitzel for dinner, you still say, I always wanted that French wine. But changing music to German and suddenly everyone's buying German wine. So if you think about the kind of popularity of North American cuisine, sort of burgers and stuff, how much of that is being driven by kind of the popularity of North American music, I don't know. That's something that people might listen to every day, and maybe, who knows, they eat burgers every day as well.
Interesting. And talking about the festival more generally, mm-hmm. have you been involved in a literary festival before? Is this your first
time? The very first time, actually.
First time.
So just had a book that came out just before Christmas, The Perfect Meal. And that's kind of, I guess, qualified me in some sense to be able to come along to these events. I went to one literary festival in the Lake District last weekend, which was great, my very first one. And this is the first time in the Oxford Festival, but I'm very excited.
Are you going to be going along to any of the other events?
I hope so. I'm doing a few other events around Europe, kind of around that time, so I'll miss some, but certainly there are a number of other food talks there that are very interesting, food events and like food writing prizes and some of the speakers who are coming into town. I very much hope that I'll get the chance to meet. And I mean, who knows how the session will go, because I haven't met Fred before. We've been in email contact, and I've seen all the books. I think it's about 6 or 7 books altogether, and certainly kind of the opera and food will make a sort of interesting match.
Yeah.
Him coming from more the musical and the food end, and myself coming more from the sort of psychological
end. But presumably
end.
He's on board with this, your kind of...
Let's hope so. who knows? So, I mean, certainly one comes across different kinds of opinions. Some who say no, or certainly some more traditional chefs would say no, it's just about the food, and don't be silly that changing the plate changes the taste, and you can't tell me that putting different, you know, Barry Manilow will change the taste of my sorbet. And it's those kind of sort of scepticism from some that kind of drives a lot of our research, and some colleagues who are quite sceptical chefs, we have them in the back of our mind when we're thinking about the experiments to do to try and develop and generate the data that will then we can take back to them and say, hey, you didn't believe us, but here's the results of 100 or 1,000 or 3,000 people, and when we change this, this is what they said about what they were tasting. And it's something you might want to incorporate. And maybe, in fact, also, probably there's a kind of a history of sort of music and food, going back to kind of taffle music in, I don't know, 16th, 17th century kind of music, especially designed for meal times. Mm. So I think it's probably a lot more juicy nuggets somewhere in the historical kind of food and music archive about linking food and music that hopefully might be revealed.
Yes.
In the session. And it's just kind of this illusion that we have that we psychologist and chef and regular person going to the restaurant or the wine, that Sonic wine bar thinks they can just taste what's in the glass and the food on the plate and think we all think we can just ignore that everything else.
Right.
But it turns out from research after research after research that you can't, and all these other things do have an impact. And that's kind of the excitement for us behind the Perfect Meal book to say,
yeah,
we can't cook. We can see how everything else has a big impact, and by doing the right sorts of studies, you can develop sort of guidelines and ideas about how to kind of nudge everyone towards a perfect meal, and a part of that perfect meal is probably about the soundtrack or the music that's playing in the background.
Do you have plans to go to any Oxford chefs around here?
I have a chef who lives in the house with us. Charles Michel is like a Franco-Colombian chef, French trained. So we have sort of dinner parties for the lab sometimes, and he cooks up stuff.
Uh-huh.
Kandinsky paintings on a canvas. We have rabbits. You eat them with knives and forks that have been kind of covered in the rabbit pelt or skin, so it's quite experimental stuff. But that's fun. And also, I'm hoping to organise a chef's scientist convention later in the summer, and actually bring one or two of the chefs that we work with in London, people like Joseph Youssef, who pops up in Maida Vale, up to Oxford, because it seemed like, you know, if you want to go to a fancy new pop-up restaurant, you have to go to London. But Oxford, there are lots of people who want to eat,
yeah,
so why couldn't we have a few pop-up interesting dining events here? And hopefully that will happen.
Great, thanks for talking to us today. If you want to catch Charles's talk with Fred Plotkin, it's on Wednesday the 25th at 12 p.m. at Corpus Christi for the Oxford Literary Festival.